Welcome to New World Notes, edited by yours truly, Kenneth Doust. Journalist, sociologist, and prophet Chris Hedges returns. He explains exactly how the economic elite managed to destroy American democracy and the social safety net. It's a fascinating story, and it begins about 100 years ago on the eve of World War I. I hope you'll stay tuned for the first half of an interesting conversation indeed. Chris Hedges has a new book, The Death of the Liberal Class. It's about the demise of the liberal institutions that used to work within the system, protecting people from ravages and oppressions by the system. These include the press, labor unions, universities, the arts, the liberal church, and the Democratic Party. By now, all of these have become ineffective, or were deliberately destroyed, like the unions, or have simply sold out, like the Democratic Party. Hedges spoke briefly on the subject, specifically on the Democratic Party, in our installment, Betrayed, at the end of November. This week and next, Hedges is speaking with Mike McCormick on Mike's excellent radio program, Mind Over Matters, out in Seattle. Here's a bit of a roadmap. After some preliminaries, Hedges takes us back to the 19-teens. Americans are overwhelmingly opposed to entering the Great War that is raging in Europe. We're going to enter it anyway to protect the bankers' profits. President Wilson, acting on behalf of J.P. Morgan, drags the citizens into this bloodbath through some oppressive new laws and, more importantly, an unprecedented massive propaganda campaign. After the war, the architects of the propaganda campaign went to work for big business, and the business of public relations was born. Business tycoons began employing the wartime propaganda techniques to remove every impediment to maximizing their own profit, such as liberal arts education, labor unions, and even core American values, such as thrift and concern for community. The process continues through today. Incidentally, as I sketch out these introductory notes, many in Congress are calling for using some of that oppressive World War I-era legislation that was designed to silence dissent against the war. They're clamoring to indict WikiLeaks founder Julian Assange under the Espionage Act of 1917. Assange's alleged crime, of course, was exposing the filth that is the daily business, so to speak, of the U.S. State Department. Here is Chris Hedges in conversation with Mike McCormick.
We are talking today with Chris Hedges, and he is here today to talk about his new book, Death of the Liberal Class. Chris, thank you very much for coming in and spending time with us today.
No, thanks for having me.
Start out and tell us, what was your motivation in writing Death of the Liberal Class?
Well, it originally began as a book for Knopf on the press, and when I turned the manuscript in, Knopf hated it. I think Knopf and I were in agreement that the destruction of the mainstream press is catastrophic, but they were uncomfortable with my critique of it, its failings, which, frankly, I think I knew a lot better than Knopf did. And they offered to take the negativity out of the book for me and publish it. And you can imagine how that went over. So I sold it to another publisher. And when I was writing the book, I kept bumping into the fact that the press hardly existed in a vacuum, that it was one of the major pillars of liberalism, classical liberalism, and that its demise and collapse had been replicated by the other pillars of the liberal establishment, the church, the liberal church, universities, arts, labor, and, of course, the Democratic Party. And so I broadened the book to look at liberalism as a whole, what had happened to it, and the consequences of the withering away of these liberal institutions within our civic democracy.
So when did the liberal class begin this death spiral?
I think you have to go back to World War I, which I do in the book, and look very closely at the powerful progressive and populist movements that were reconfiguring American society on the eve of World War I. We had a strong socialist movement, radical labor unions. The wealthy power elite was in retreat, a few dozen socialist mayors across the country and many in fairly large cities. Publications like Appeal to Reason, The Masses, had very wide circulation. And as the great political theorist Dwight MacDonald wrote, the war was the rock on which these movements broke. What happened in World War I had a profound impact on coloring of American society. The war was not popular. Wilson, in fact, had run for re-election on the slogan, "He kept us out of the war." But the bankers, Wall Street, once again, which had lent tremendous sums to the British and the French, were terrified that if the Germans won the war, they would not get their loans repaid, they would not get their money back. And so they pushed us into the war. And Wilson had terrible recruiting problems, and there was tremendous opposition to the entrance in the war. And they created the first system of modern mass propaganda, the Committee for Public Information, or the Creel Commission, which had a kind of diabolical brilliance. And figures like Walter Lippmann comes off in his book Public Opinion, which is a really foundational text for how to, as Lippmann calls it, manufacture consent. They built a system of propaganda that crossed all disciplinary lines. They had a news division, they had a film division that practically paid for itself, you know, producing Kaiser the Butcher of Berlin kind of movies, graphic artists, they had speakers bureaus. But more importantly, they employed the understanding of mass psychology that had been explored by Le Bon and Trotter and Sigmund Freud. And Edward Bernays, who is considered sort of the father of modern public relations, was in the Committee for Public Information. He was actually Freud's nephew twice over. And it was this understanding that people are not moved by fact or reason. They're moved by the skillful manipulation of emotions. People can confuse knowledge for how they are made to feel. And so when you read writers like Randolph Bourne, or Jane Addams, who held out against this war fervor, much of their despair is not only about how essentially the masses were seduced by the war propaganda, but the intellectual class itself. Wilson pushed through the Sedition Act and the Espionage Act, but in fact he didn't have to use overt repression against most of the society. It was only that marginal fringe which refused to cooperate with a war effort, and of course this landed figures like Eugene Debs eventually in prison. After the war, two things happened. This massive propaganda machine, which interestingly was very closely studied by Goebbels and the Nazis. Bernays' book Propaganda was one of the instrumental books that Goebbels used to build the Nazi propaganda movement. You had the dreaded Hun instantly replaced with the dreaded Red, and you saw the more overt legislation like the Espionage Act and the Sedition Act used to crush the remnants of radical populist movements with the Palmer raids and publications like Appeal to Reason, although it had been forced to support the war and its editorial policy during the war was shut down along with the masses. And all of these figures moved to Madison Avenue like Bernays and began working for corporations, saturating American society, upending traditional American values of thrift and self-effacement to replace it with the values of mass consumption, to instill consumption as a kind of inner compulsion. We began a culture that, again, MacDonald refers to as the culture of permanent war, where there's always an enemy, external and internal, the whole sort of Cold War ideology, which became an effective mechanism to cow the population into passivity and purge those elements within society that retained a kind of radical critique of structures and assumptions. So you had a decimation of populist movements, labor movements and independent press. Liberal institutions would carry out purges within themselves because of this sort of fear of being pink or being red. And the population itself, locked into kind of the psychology of fear, accepted an increasing intrusion of the state into their lives. As Randolph Bourne wrote, you know, war is the health of the state. And I think we've never recovered from that. The political and social theorists of the late 19th century, including Karl Marx, never grappled with the concept of mass propaganda and permanent war. It wasn't something that was on their radar screen. And that was really the start of our descent.
Was there any real resistance to this from any of the different sectors that you identified for that make up the liberal class?
If you read Malcolm Cowley's great book, An Exile's Return, which is an intellectual history of the period, he argues, I think correctly, that when you look at the Bohemians and later the Beats and even the New Left in the 1960s, the core values that they embraced were the values that had been inculcated into the American public by public relations firms and corporations, values of hedonism, the cult of the self, which was a radical departure. I think that what the public relations industry that was, of course, serving corporate interests was able to do quite effectively was destroy American culture or American cultures, because we once had many cultures, ethnic cultures, regional cultures, with their own sense of identity and self-expression, so that there was an homogenization of American culture and a reconfiguring of the values of that culture. And I think it's probably better described as corporate culture. That's what was bequeathed to us. Now, we saw, of course, in the 1930s, the breakdown of capitalism. And that was a dramatic illustration of why liberal institutions and the liberal class are vital to a state, because they provide channels or mechanisms within the power structure by which the grievances and suffering of large sectors of the population can be addressed. So we still had vibrant labor unions, although they'd suffered. We had progressive Democrats, people like Henry Wallace and Roosevelt himself, who pushed through the New Deal. And as Conrad Black in his biography of Roosevelt correctly points out, what Roosevelt did in essence was save capitalism. After World War II, strikes were illegal during the war, although there were many, but there was a series of strikes right after the war, a kind of rebirth of labor, and they passed in the name of anti-communism, the Taft-Hartley Act in 1948, which was probably the most destructive piece of labor legislation until NAFTA. And then, of course, we began with Joe McCarthy. And it's interesting that George Creel, who ran the Creel Commission for Wilson, ended his career working for McCarthy and Nixon in the House Un-American Affairs Activity Committee. So you had then a ruthless purging of, and it's not fair to call them communists, but people who practiced a kind of moral autonomy, socialists, people who didn't buy into the narrow, rigid Cold War ideology. Thousands of professors and high school teachers and social workers lost their job. That's how America's greatest journalist of the 20th century, I.F. Stone, became a pariah. He couldn't even get a job at The Nation magazine, finally, and starts printing I.F. Stone's Weekly in his basement with his wife. And so those last remnants were decimated, and the liberal class itself, even institutions like the ACLU, willingly bought into these witch hunts. And who is it that carried out the witch hunts? Well, they were the careerists. They were the people with the least sort of moral core who were willing to denounce, you know, many of their colleagues who didn't embrace this kind of orthodoxy. So as we saw the rise of the corporate state, deregulation, unfettered capitalism, we had lost the radical movements that could give us the kind of language of class warfare and the broad critique and the militancy to fight back. And we had also lost the liberal institutions who once played this very important role of balancing power between populist movements and the power elite itself. And we saw, with the rise of Bill Clinton, a very calculated effort to seek corporate money and do corporate bidding. Clinton knew that labor and the working class had nowhere else to go. And with the passage of NAFTA, the deregulation of the FCC, so-called welfare reform in 1996, the destruction of our banking system. Canada doesn't have a banking crisis because Larry Summers didn't rip down the firewalls, or Larry Summers like figure didn't rip down the firewalls between commercial and investment banks. And so that by the 1990s, the Democratic Party had fundraising parity with the Republicans, and by the time Barack Obama ran for president, the Democrats got more. But they sold out the working class. They sold out traditional liberal values. We've had a frightening consolidation of the press, of the commercial media, the corporate press. There's roughly six corporations that control just about everything most Americans see, watch, read, or hear. That's Rupert Murdoch's News Corp, Viacom, General Electric, Disney. Universities have become corporatized, withering of the humanities. Whole departments are forced often to find funding not only for their own research and grants, but their own salaries. So you have a slashing of philosophy departments, theater departments. University of Albany just abolished classics along with most foreign languages, German, Italian, French. And schools become increasingly vocational, especially state schools where you have budget cuts. You can get corporations to fund your business school, but they're not going to pay for students to read Camus. And, of course, accompanying that is a decline of labor unions. I live in the state of New Jersey, and our governor is very busy dismantling the teachers' unions. The last readout of union strength is in the public sector, and even that is being decimated.
On New World Notes, we are listening to Chris Hedges discuss how present-day U.S. got to be its dreary self. In the next section, Hedges discusses the program of destroying the institutions that tended to shift some power to the people. And he shows the bad results: the destruction of the ecosystem, the decay of once thriving cities, the impoverishment of a once prosperous people, and, since real reformers are suppressed, the rise of corporate-controlled demagogues to mislead a justifiably angry people. One point that's a bit subtle. Hedges mentions that you can't buy a tomato in Camden, New Jersey. The irony is that Camden is in southern New Jersey, and South Jersey is, or was, a major center for growing produce, especially tomatoes. When I was a boy outside of Philadelphia, fresh Jersey tomatoes were one of the delights of summer. Now, New Jersey supermarkets sell tasteless pink tomatoes shipped up from Mexico. And in Camden, you can't get even that, because there aren't any supermarkets there anymore. That's why the Campbell's Soup Factory was in Camden. The tomatoes. Back to Chris Hedges.
So do you believe the power elite and the corporations had this plan from the start? Or was it, you know, multiple corporations and wealthy people kind of each doing it piecemeal and it just worked out well?
Well, there's always been a deep hostility to populist movements that inhibited the ability to make maximum profit. And the assault on the universities began at the turn of the century with figures like Mellon and Carnegie, who wanted to train young people to serve business and hated the fact that they were being educated in the liberal arts, which is, of course, if it's done right, is meant to challenge assumptions and structures and ask uncomfortable questions and critique the status quo. And, of course, at its core, it's about values. So it's not a new phenomena, but they altered and adjusted their tactics. You saw in the 1960s a very concerted effort to bring down Ralph Nader with a Powell memo, Lewis Powell, who eventually ended up on the Supreme Court, which I reprint in the book. And he brought in tremendous amounts of resources and corporate money, created the Business Roundtable, along with these conservative foundations, which ended with the collusion of the Democratic Party, Nader becoming a kind of pariah in American society. So I think that these inclinations are not new, but it's been a long process because they have had to slowly dismantle the barricades that prevented unfettered capitalism from reconfiguring American society into a kind of neo-feudalistic state, which is rapidly what we are becoming now. There's been a Weimarization of the American working class. NAFTA saw the kind of final destruction of our manufacturing base. There are whole pockets of the United States that resemble the developing world. I just did a story for The Nation magazine on Camden, New Jersey, which per capita is the poorest city in the United States and not coincidentally the most dangerous. And there are no jobs, literally no jobs. And Camden was once an industrial hub. It once had a huge shipyard. RCA Victor was there. Campbell Soup was there. All gone. 5,000 abandoned buildings, 100 open-air drug markets, 77% of the city budget is spent on police and fire. And these post-industrial pockets are spreading outwards. There's no supermarket in the center of Camden because agribusinesses have created a system by which fruits and vegetables, if you live in the state of New Jersey, are shipped across country, and poor people can't buy tomatoes, so they don't sell it to them. We are creating a kind of permanent underclass, and it's especially as state and federal programs are slashed. I mean, we are now facing the very real prospect that unemployment benefits will not be extended, and many people will have to attempt to survive on the $143 a month you receive from welfare, courtesy of the Democratic Party and Bill Clinton. The danger of closing that kind of safety valve that liberal institutions and the liberal class provided is that as discontent grows, it is expressed in very anti-democratic form. And we are seeing that already with the Tea Party and militia movements. Coupled with a rage against government is a rage against liberals. And I think that rage is not misplaced. I think the liberal establishment, which continues to speak in the language of traditional liberalism, has betrayed the very people that they purportedly defend, whose interests they defend. And I watched the breakup of Yugoslavia, the collapse of Yugoslavia, and I find very many similar parallels. You can go back and look at the collapse of Tsarist Russia. Dostoevsky is obsessed with this collapse of liberalism. It's what Notes from Underground is about. It's what Demons is about. It's the underground man, the defeated dreamer, that figure who went to all the Obama rallies and chanted, "Yes, we can," then feels betrayed and says, well, only the buffoons and the idiots take over, and removes themselves from social engagement. And when that happens, Dostoevsky argues, your society descends into what he calls an age of moral nihilism. And I'm terrified. The same withering away of the liberal establishment is what permitted buffoonish and ridiculous figures like Radovan Karadzic or Slobodan Milosevic or Franjo Tuđman to be vomited up from the economic collapse of Yugoslavia. We're not immune from that at all. So, although I'm very critical of the liberal establishment, because it certainly in the end serves the interests of the power elite, one of the prime functions and the reasons the power elite tolerates liberal institutions is because they are the most effective attack dogs against radicals. I mean, I think the figure that self-identified liberals probably detest most is not Glenn Beck, but Noam Chomsky, because he calls them out on this. You can see it in when they do the retrospectives of the war in Iraq. You know, you had the liberal establishment, including my former editor at the New York Times, Bill Keller, identifying themselves as reluctant hawks. It pains me to do this, but it's the right thing to do. Well, that's the classic role of the liberal establishment. And now in the retrospectives of the war, they say, well, we weren't prepared for the insurgency, we weren't prepared for the occupation, but our motives were pure. We went in to bring democracy and stop genocide and create liberty. And that is the classical role of liberalism. You don't cross those parameters of questioning the intent of the power elite itself. And if you do that, then you are thrust outside of liberal institutions very quickly.
So there's a difference between the liberal class and the liberal establishment. Liberal establishment sounds like it's still surviving to a degree.
Well, but it doesn't function anymore. They've reduced themselves to the role of courtiers because they have no power. The last 2 years of the Obama administration is a perfect example of the bankruptcy of American liberalism, because the Democrats came in and, in essence, codified the destruction of domestic and international law that was put in place by the Bush administration. Not only in terms of the furtherance of our imperial projects, the preemptive war, which under post-Nuremberg laws is defined as a criminal war of aggression, not only did they continue the looting of the U.S. Treasury on behalf of Wall Street speculators and swindlers who committed crimes through mortgage brokers and bankers, filling out fraudulent loan applications, giving money to people who they knew could never pay it back, and then selling these bundled derivatives as assets. The Obama administration has not confronted this severe dislocation that has been visited on millions of American citizens, 2.8 million people who lost their homes last year from bank repossessions and foreclosures, matched by another 3 million this year. The so-called health care reform bill is a sham. It's the equivalent of the bank bailout bill for the for-profit health care industry, essentially $400 billion in subsidies for the pharmaceutical and insurance corporations, and now we're sitting around watching them grant exemptions because these corporations don't want to insure chronically ill children, on and on and on. And one of the things that the right wing is doing very well is tarring Obama, not only as a liberal, but they're calling him a socialist, because it is a way to discredit the values. And the sad fact is that the very destructive forces, corporate forces that created the mess, because of an anemic liberal class, will benefit from the misery that they created. I mean, you saw the New Yorker just ran this long piece on how the Koch brothers are, you know, pumping tremendous amounts of sums into the Tea Party and deflecting attention away from Wall Street towards government with very disturbing undertones of racism towards Obama and racism towards undocumented workers and Muslims. I mean, it's the classic finding, you know, channeling that rage or directing that rage towards weak scapegoats. And, you know, we live in a period of relative stability, but the worldwide currency crisis is serious. If you look at the recent front pages of the Wall Street Journal and the New York Times and what's happening to the euro and countries like Ireland and Italy and potentially Spain, we're not immune from that. I mean, we're playing a very desperate game trying to monetize our debt with $600 billion, which means, in essence, we're printing $600 billion of money. There's debate, and I'm not an economist, there's debate across the spectrum as to whether or not it will work, but there is no debate over the fact that if it does not work, the consequences could be catastrophic. They want to create inflation, but can you create inflation and prevent hyperinflation? Can we sustain a level of consumption and an empire through the selling of debt forever? We sell $2 billion of debt a day to the Chinese with $12.8 trillion in deficits, the largest, I think, in human history. That's about 96 to service that will be about $96 billion a week we'll have to sell. And if China and the oil-rich nations don't buy it, then we're the Federal Reserve will buy it, which means we'll just print more money. It's not a sustainable solution over the long run. And if it all goes south, then, as I saw in Yugoslavia, where we endured hyperinflation on the eve of the war and massive unemployment and large-scale factory closures, if it all goes south, then that economic catastrophe will empower a very frightening right-wing populism, which we are already seeing gravitate towards the centers of power with the midterm elections. And it's not coincidental that the environmental crisis is twinned with the economic crisis, because corporations view everything, human beings and the natural world, as commodities that they exploit until exhaustion or collapse. I mean, even if we stopped all carbon emissions today, we would still rise to about 550 parts per million, 350 parts per million being that amount which has sustained the human species throughout our history. And we stand by as the industrialized nations and corporations go to Copenhagen and shred Kyoto, as if climate change isn't real, as if it's not happening. So the consequences of an unchecked corporatism, both for us as a nation and finally for the planet itself, are deadly. I mean, quite literally. And the normal mechanisms by which civilians or citizens can be heard have shut down. We've undergone a coup d'etat in slow motion, and they've won, and we've lost.
Thanks for listening. Thanks to Mike McCormick and Mind Over Matters. Thanks to the University of Hartford and WWUH-FM. We'll have more of the conversation with Chris Hedges next week. NewWorldNotes.blogspot.com. Illicit to my non-carborundum, and catch you later.